This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN? Oh, what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits: enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform: Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found — I am not a therapist — I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it, and sometimes it makes you realize, like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
You're listening to an iFanboy Special Edition podcast. We're talking with writer Paul Cornell of Captain Britain and MI-13 and Doctor Who. Hey, we are here with writer Paul Cornell. This is Josh, and I'm here with
Connor.
There he is. Hi, Paul.
Oh, hi. Thanks very much for having me.
You sound as if you might be very far away. Where are you?
Well, I'm in Oxfordshire as we speak, sitting at my desk.
Oh, my word. Do you have tea there?
Actually, just a second ago, you missed it.
That's exactly how it's supposed to go. You know, Paul, looking over, you've written a lot of stuff.
Well, yeah, thank you. I've been at this quite a long time, actually. It's, I've always wanted to write comics, but it's only in the last couple of years that I've actually had the chance to do that branch of the stuff I do, yeah.
Well, it's odd. You've actually sort of gone backwards, because a lot of people start in comics and then end up doing TV and novels, and you kind of went the other way around.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think this is part of Marvel's whole let's look to other media to find writers thing.
Have you been reading comics your whole life, and it just like this is what have you been trying to get here, or did you just get lucky with it? And
well, kind of a mixture of all three. I mean, there's I mostly have spent my whole life reading comics, mm-hmm. From being taught to read by British reprints of Lee and Kirby when I was tiny, and thus I was the only kid on my block. Not that we had a block. That's extraordinary, isn't it? Block. There wasn't a house next to mine in the middle of the Wiltshire countryside, never mind a block. But I was the only kid within shouting distance who knew what a base defiler was, because, you know, Stan Lee conned Shakespearean, you know, oh, thou base defiler. You know, so that's the vocabulary I grew up with. And then I kind of moved from superhero titles to Vertigo titles when I was a teenager and going to college. And then one of my favourite Vertigo titles kind of changed author or came to an end, I kind of stopped comics. But then I came back in when I met my wife, or my wife-to-be, and we went to see the X-Men movie, and she said, do you have any of those comics? And I brought down these huge cases from the loft and got her addicted. And we sort of were walking past a comic shop one day, and she said, I wonder what the X-Men are like now. And so I went back inside, and I got really re-addicted as a result of romance and started buying all these superhero comics again.
What was the first title that really got you when you came back in?
Well, I did... we have certain titles we associate with our courting, one of which was Exiles, because we bought that from the beginning. And Green Arrow, starting with Kevin Smith's run.
Right.
And because my wife was immediately interested in Kitty Pryde, we dived into the back issue bins and immediately got the Pride and Wisdom series from a few years before. Then the whole Pete Wisdom run on Excalibur. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm coming from. I have a powerful association between Pete Wisdom and my own love life. What can I say?
Well, how did you get from sort of having being a fan of Pete Wisdom to writing a series about him then?
Well, amazingly, that was the character Nick Lowe asked me about.
Are you breaking out of a prison right now?
Well, of course, it's an urban wasteland outside, and there's some kind of riot going on. Across the churchyard, where I can see those wonderful trees, and it's a nice sunny day here in Oxfordshire, and there's some hideousness happening outside. Sorry about that. How's that for the recording?
It's fine. According to the spooks that I've been watching, that's pretty much what it's like all the time over there, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, there are flashes of gunfire in the night. It's extraordinary. What was the question again? It was a good question, but I've forgotten it.
You got to you did the first thing you did with Marvel was Wisdom, and that was the character you were a big fan of, apparently.
Well, yeah, Mark Miller sent me an email after one of my Doctor Who episodes saying, I really like that. Would you like to work for Marvel Comics? I wish one could frame emails and put them on the wall. It was a lovely moment, that one. And, so I got into the process. I met Nick, and his first thought was, let's do a Pete Wisdom British Intelligence-style comic. Mm-hmm. And he sent me piles of Wisdom photocopies from comics I already had, so it was kind of like, well, hey.
What is it about Pete Wisdom? Like, what is it that really connected you to him?
Well, I love the kind of British everyman aspect. I have a favourite moment from that Excalibur run, where he's being, you know, interrogated by a psychic mutant who's looking into the depths of his mind and confronting him with his greatest nightmares and all that. And the psychic finally sort of explodes because he sees in Pete's mind things that are much more evil and tentacly than he was expecting. And it's all turned around in a wonderfully ironic British way. And that's what I really like about him, actually. He's... he could be a superhero, but he just thinks wearing a costume would be ridiculous. And maybe he hasn't quite got the abdomen for it. And he just likes splitting up that fashion line with a long coat. And all of this, and being a certain age, and being, if I wasn't happily married, romantically rather wistful and useless, blundering from random shag to random shag like a man hopping through a minefield, as he does, I find all of this tremendously relatable. And, I think that's the thing about him. He's a very relatable British character. A British male reading him will know where he's coming from. I think the voice, I think he's sort of like a younger Michael Caine. So I have him pointing a lot in the comic, you know, kind of insisting like that. which I don't know why, I just did Dick Van Dyke. Do you know, I loved it the other day when you were doing the review and you went into John the Skrull impersonations. And I'd actually just got over, I was in a big traffic accident, and I had broken ribs, and you actually hurt my sides to the point of physical pain through your John the Skrull impersonation. So, well done.
Nice, Josh. Good, Josh.
You're welcome.
If your aim was to cause me physical pain, well, mission accomplished.
Well, once again. Well, let me ask you, and I don't want to be too insensitive about this, but Wisdom wasn't really, it wasn't like, didn't make a huge impact on the scene.
No, I think I've met everybody who read it, yeah, individually.
I mean, to be completely honest, I don't think I ever heard of it, but you still decided to stick with the character and then use him in the Captain Britain MI-13 series.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember actually you mentioned it in passing on the podcast. Somebody wrote in saying, I really like that Wisdom series, and the three of you said, Wisdom? What's that? Is that a Vertigo book? No, that's a Marvel book that's like a Vertigo book, and you left it at that. And I think Josh said something about there were fairies on the cover, and that just ruled it out. Not that I'm bitter, but...
Just because I can cause you physical pain, I also thought I would also try for psychological pain, so just to get everything covered.
2 out of 2.
Yeah.
And he's kind of the obvious choice. I mean, sort of, this is the title that Nick was kind of originally after, an MI-13 title. Mm-hmm. And, Pete's very much a part of that. If you're doing a British superhero intelligence title, he's going to be in the mix. Captain Britain is way, way high in the mix, though, and we're playing it off all these different relationships within the team, and Cap and Pete are really important, because in the past, when they've met, they've been kind of a little at loggerheads, but at the moment, because everybody's been doing loggerheads for a couple of years now, notably Civil War, and Marvel's heroes are still at loggerheads, I'm trying to find that next thing along, which I think everybody is going to come to, and it's just the natural thing. I'm not claiming any great prescience here, of seeing what happens when heroes get along with each other. And giving our bunch good reasons to be together, and certainly dramatic tension and dramatic conflict, but also giving them a cause and a uniting thing, and finding points of commonality between Brian and Pete. And they're getting quite a fast friendship now, and find that easy to write, because they've got a lot more in common than that which divides them. Notably, both tremendous sense of duty.
Wait a minute, is Brian not dead?
Well, of course, he is, as we speak, dead. Yes.
He is the title character.
Yes, indeed, and he is thus dead. But, noticeably, I haven't been saying Brian throughout this interview. I've been talking about Captain Britain.
Sure.
And his or her or its relationship to Pete.
Let me ask you, because Captain Britain, you described Pete Wisdom and why you like him. Captain Britain seems to me to be as far from that as you can get with the costumes and the brightly colored. I mean,
yeah,
he is not the guy who is not wanting to be a superhero. What is it about Captain Britain? Is he as appealing to the British as Captain America is to the Americans?
Oh, well, that's what we're after. And I think that hasn't been in place very often before.
Right.
He's kind of, in America, he's always seen as the other. Right. And he's often been written, often very well, as that other thing. Notably, Chris Claremont's excellent Excalibur run, where the whole British superhero team thing is an excuse to do a wonderfully warm, fluffy, surreal, and gentle comedy. And that's great. It's a book that feels like a hug. but at the same time, it's not Captain Britain as our Captain America. Right. And to a British audience, we always felt when people like Alan Moore weren't writing him and doing brilliant, wonderful things. I'm also a huge fan of the Jamie Delano run. That, we deserve a Captain Britain who is our Captain America.
Right.
And so he isn't the other. He's the obvious thing. He's the central thing. And what I really wanted to do with this book, and which I got to do in the first issue, and of course won't be able to do anymore because he's dead,
right,
is put a Captain Britain who is our Cap. who British people will say, yes, that's our hero, both in the book and in the readership. Yeah, and, you know, I think it's actually quite a bit of repositioning, because even Alan Moore, because this was, you know, his go at a superhero title, and I think at the time he thought it was probably his only one, he wanted to deconstruct the hero. You know, it was kind of a step on the way to Miracle Man for him. So he doesn't do the central, steadfast British hero either. He does the falling apart, deconstructed hero. So, you know, I have this wonderful source for stuff, Stuart Vandal, who works on the official handbooks, who I talk to about continuity things. And I asked him, is Captain Britain an alcoholic? And he got really passionate. And he sent me a list of the four occasions upon which Brian Braddock has been seen drinking. two of which he got drunk. Once he gets drunk a bit too much at Excalibur, and they say, you're getting a bit drunk a bit too much, so he throws all his whiskey away in the way that alcoholics can't, you know.
Right.
And, you know, it's things like this that every weakness and neuroses has been projected onto this man. And we're just going to be rid of a lot of that and give him some more, or her, or it, some more central dramatic conflict, but still retaining, you know, the heroism. I'm really enjoying Dan Dare at the moment, as I know you are.
Oh, it's so good.
And that's proper British heroism. I mean, that's the Dan I remember from my own childhood. And I want some of that for Captain Britain. You know, I want some of that genuine, what might be mocked as stiff upper lipness, a certain stoicism, a certain emotional, not deadness, but an unwilling to share emotionally that nevertheless creates a sort of toughness. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I've been going on and on. Please ask away.
That's why we're here. Well, let me ask you, you put together a superhero team, and sort of the holy grail in superhero comics is sort of the forming of the team and putting things together. I mean, were these the characters you were given, or did you sort of place them all together specifically, or what were you thinking when you were putting this team together?
Well, it's a bit of both. Originally, I just created a big list of every British hero I might want to use, and I sort of found every British hero, including guys who'd wandered on for one panel in the Civil War frontline. There is a Welsh dragon who is in Civil War frontline very, very briefly. And, you know, so we went through a big list. And I always say about this book that it's a three-way team. It's me, editor Nick Lowe, and artist Leonard Kirk. And for me, coming from television, this is great because, you know, there's somebody you can instantly say, how about this to? And he will either be able to say yes or no within a day. And television is great, but there's lots and lots of people to satisfy. It's a big team. And, you know, you've got an awful lot of levels, and you won't get an answer immediately. And I would say it's almost a co-write between me and Nick Lowe, about a 90-10 co-write on my side, because he comes up with fantastic ideas. He's always there to shape what I'm doing, to pull it back, to say, actually, to sometimes say, you haven't quite got the comics grammar here yet, though he's giving me a wider and wider leash on that, so I guess I'm getting there. And also, he comes up with cracking, immediate suggestions that change the whole course of what we're doing. I'm really pleased to be working with him. It's a great relationship.
It must be fun in comics, but to be able to sort of change direction that quickly, whereas I'm guessing in the television shows, you can't really do that.
Well, no, it's like an oil tanker turning.
Right.
You know, we've got a choppy little speedboat or a pedalo. And so choosing the team.
Oh, yeah.
Some of it was me saying I want the Black Knight, and some of it was him saying what about Blade? And I think he also said what about Spitfire? You know, it's sort of we got it chopped down through that to numbers that would work for a team. But then I said, oh, but every British hero is de facto a member of MI-13, so we can just pull in a fun hero for, you know, a two-page appearance or, you know, for a couple of issues. And that's working really well. I'm really enjoying that.
I was going to ask you about Blade. So he's going to join the team, and apparently he's from London?
In fact, he wasn't just born here. He spent something like the first 20 years of his life here, became Blade the Vampire Hunter in London. All of this was more than a century ago. Mm-hmm. And
so Wesley Snipes really ruined that for everyone.
Well, I think he's been in America for a very long time and lost his. He doesn't suddenly get a British speech pattern when he comes back over here. But I'm really a fan of the movies. I'm sort of doing a little bit of adapting the movie Blade back into comics via the recent series, and sort of taking the best from everywhere and putting him in a British setting, which is really interesting. He adds something to the team. The relationships he creates within the team are really interesting.
Yeah, that's a very different pairing, I suppose. I mean, will they be fighting vampires, or will he, you know... Is he good for other things?
Yeah, he's good for other things. He's good for harsh truths and being the absolute fanatical warrior when he has to be. And being the one who'll say, no, we just have to kill them all. Mm-hmm. We have, at the end of issue 4, it becomes clear what the ongoing aim of the team is to be, why they're going to be a team. Mm-hmm. And in issue 5, we sort all of that out, and epilogue our first 4 issues, and prologue our next 4 issues. And there is going to be an ongoing purpose to this team, which will with which Blade fits tremendously.
Are you tied into? I mean, how long are you tied into Secret Invasion, and at what point do you sort of go off into your own thing? I guess, or is it indefinite?
First four issues are a Secret Invasion tie-in. Fifth issue is an epilogue to that.
Okay.
So you know that's where we're actually going to be pumping extra hard to try and keep the level of interest up. Oh, I got to tell you, just announced yesterday, okay, we sold out issue 2 again. We're on a third printing now.
That's good.
It's a very popular book.
About 6 covers across 2 issues so far. It's like Image all over again. But not Image. What am I talking about?
It must be very gratifying to have this book be so popular.
Oh, it's amazing, especially over here, where that Gordon Brown story in Britain was enormous.
You keep mentioning things before I get to them in my questions, and I don't appreciate it.
Sorry, pardon me. You haven't noticed the webcam.
Tell me about this Gordon Brown story.
Well, I was suddenly woken up, and I was recording a radio play in BBC Manchester, and I was woken up at 5 a.m. by Radio 5, who wanted to suddenly talk to me about Gordon Brown. We thought putting the Prime Minister in issue 1 of the comic was going to get us, you know, a mention in the Gossip Diary media column in The Guardian on page 26. Mm-hmm. But obviously, it was a slow news week, and suddenly we're all over the place in the British tabloids, and actually not often a very silly story. We were in a lot of broadcast media. They gave the comics the credit quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And nicely, because if you're in London, it's pretty easy to pop into Forbidden Planet. You know, we did see sales go up as a result, and I'm very pleased with that. Joe Quesada found himself on, you know, various news talk shows talking about Gordon Brown. It was a surreal little week.
So just for people who aren't there, don't know, explain what the reaction was. And
our Prime Minister at the moment is going through a choppy patch, as all politicians mm-hmm. do almost all the time. And the idea of him being portrayed in the comic being decisive and useful and solid in a crisis really appealed to the satirical sense of an awful lot of British newspapers and broadcasters, it turned out. So, all in all, we didn't expect it. We certainly didn't plan it. But I'm now going to bring out a range of British politicians who will be appearing in issue 6.
Leader of Parliament the issue.
Absolutely. Maybe we should have the Skrulls just attack Parliament there and then. I don't know. But, yeah.
So does all this comic book success give you more credits with your wife? Does she now look at you differently? Sort of, is there a glow about you now?
TV was fine, but comics.
There is a bit of that, yeah. I think she would prefer it if I had the big eyes and floppy hair of a manga hero. because her big thing is anime and manga.
And, oh, she switched over then.
Well, yeah, she did. she kind of she got sucked in through comics, if you like, and then moved over to you know, that side of stuff.
And, man, we're doomed. Western comics are doomed.
Well, if you include everything as comics, my right. goodness, you could say the form has never been more successful than a lot, sure. right?
That's true.
Absolutely.
So just to finish up on MI-13, are there any of the characters, I mean, are there any that stood out to you that you've really come to like over the course of writing it that you were surprised about?
Yeah, I'm kind of really fond of them all, but the Black Knight is certainly getting all my love at the moment, you know. I mean, there's something, because he's been played in so many different ways, mm-hmm. and there's something about comics characters, they're sort of, because almost uniquely, in comics, a new creator will feel able to mess with the history and the character of a character. And it sort of gives long-term comics heroes a kind of layering. Mm-hmm. You know, people think that they know what the core values of a character are, but they actually change quite appreciably. And if the creator's been successful, people kind of assume that layer was always there. You know, unless it's Hawkman or something, where they've actually had to formalize the process of change there. But with Dane, who'd been written in so many different ways, and had kind of piled up these kind of geological layers of character, finding a way to play him was really interesting. And I think I did such lengthy work on, you know, reading up about him and finding a way to get into him, that they're all my voice in different ways. You know, I really love Spitfire's brittleness and that World War II stoicism about her. And the fact that she is still a young woman despite that and doesn't talk all jolly hockey sticks all the time. And of course, Pete is Pete, and I adore Cap. And John the Skrull has given me another voice, which I'm really loving as well.
I imagine that's going to be a ton of fun.
Oh, goodness, yeah. And of course, Phasia gives me this whole other dimension to stuff. I went along to a BBC Wales Faith in Broadcasting conference to talk about my work on Doctor Who, and I met these lovely bunch of Muslim ladies, and I told them, you know, I've got a Muslim hero coming up, heroine in Captain Britain, and they were all, oh yeah, you know, send it to us, let us see. So I asked Nick, and I've sort of got them on board as a kind of unofficial checking over what I'm doing committee, especially since one of their daughters is a young doctor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's been just a sort of a way into a culture in Britain I didn't know enough about, and it has given me a real, you know, a real way of looking into this.
I've got to say, a character like that is, I mean, you could be playing with fire with that kind of character. I mean, but it seems like it's going over well.
I think you're only playing with fire if you do it crap.
True.
To be absolutely honest. Because, to be honest, there's a whole audience out there who I've met who really would like to be represented like this. They're not necessarily going to be natural readers of comics. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we all would like to think that there is a comic superhero out there representing our own interests. I think Captain Oxfordshire, as played by Stephen Fry, would probably go down really well. And you know, you've just got to basically be honest to the character and not doing, you know, outrageous things with her for the sake of outrageous things. Mm-hmm. And since she's a hero, she'll be behaving heroically.
Right.
It doesn't actually fence off anything for me. Mm-hmm. She's not going to be drinking alcohol. She's not going to be behaving in a promiscuous way. But goodness, that counts for most of our characters except Pete, frankly. In that we've had four issues of High Speed War Book, where nobody's really had time to behave in a promiscuous way apart from Pete. And actually, it's been four issues. I'm really going to have to get him a relationship of some sort quite soon. But because that part of my brain labeled Pete Wisdom sort of says he ought to be doing this shortly. Who knows who with? I don't know. but there's a hint of it with Tink again. But no, Phasey has been just an absolute dream, and her voice again, all these different voices really appeal to me, and I love the way the voices go together. And this sounds almost like I've got some kind of horrible mental condition, doesn't it? I hear the different voices and see how they go together.
Well, it sounds to me like you really like writing the book, and I think that shows, which is...
Well, yeah, it's a dream come true, frankly.
You've got Fantastic Four, True Story coming up, which is sounds like a pretty unique kind of take on Fantastic Four.
Well, I was really pleased to be asked by Tom Brevoort, do you have a FF story for miniseries? And I wanted to do them as explorers, because that's the FF I really enjoy, and had to come up with something they haven't explored, and fiction they hadn't explored. So I sort of sorted out a Marvel Fictoverse, where all fiction lives, and sorted out a battle against an original Marvel villain, one of the first wave Marvel villains, created by Stan Lee, that the Fantastic Four have never met, according to my continuity guys. Which takes doing, because everybody met everybody, particularly in the 1990s when nobody was reading it. And indeed, hope maybe we've missed it, and everybody was, oh no, they met. But now I'm really enjoying it. It's the Fantastic Four venturing into fiction in the Fictocraft, to sort out the human race's vast, losing all sense of excitement and being all depressed problem, which is something to do with books. There's a problem in the relationship between the human race and books. So the Fantastic Four plunge into the unconscious mind of Willy Lumpkin, who is a tremendous reader, and go to find the world of books that... at least that of those whose authors have been dead 75 years.
Was it hard? Yeah. Was that a hard series to pitch, or did that go over really well right away?
Well, Tom really seemed to like the idea, and the art style really suits it. It's this really kind of swirly faux manga Euro style, which we've got Ben Grimm as a kind of idealized chocolate soldier. Not chocolate, but you know what I mean. When you've got a Napoleonic War soldier with a big black hat and buttons down his tunic and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you stare into the Fictiverse also stares into you. Oh. And when he meets the Dashwood sisters from Sense and Sensibility, they see him as their hero and as a dashing lieutenant. And I get to have next issue reader, I clobbered him. And
I should hope.
Yes, it is a truth universally acknowledged that on occasion it is clobbering time. And, and you know, Johnny gets to meet Mr. Toad and all that, and it's kind of irony hits twee in a sort of extraordinary collision. There's big adventure too, and it all gets rather dark as well, because if you're amongst fiction and you can be any moment become part of it and be affected by the things around you, then if things start taking a dark turn, they can accelerate in that direction. It all gets a bit scary. And I'm loving the covers as well as the interior art. I think we've got a really nice team on that one.
When do we see that come out?
First issue's this month. I really should know which week this month. Maybe next week.
Soon
July.
Enough.
Before San Diego, that's really the one you want to hit the thing. I can honestly say that sounds like no other Fantastic Four story I've ever heard.
Yeah, but is that a good thing? That's
no, it's very good, because I can imagine when somebody says pitch something for Fantastic Four, you have to be like, oh my god. It's like pitching a Simpsons episode. There's nothing left at this point.
Well, absolutely. Finding something I hadn't done was really pleasing.
Now you are you know, primarily known for your work with Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell, I'll be completely honest with you. We don't know much about Doctor Who. We know of it. I know it's a thing. It's a very big thing for some people. I mean, what is it about Doctor Who that's such a? It's been on
TV for 75 years or something like that.
Right. It's like Star Wars, but with a scarf.
It started on the day President Kennedy was assassinated.
Nice.
There's nothing else linking those two things, I'm sure. And it's just this huge British institution that had lain fallow for a while, and then Russell T. Davis, the great writer, brought it back. and we get huge audiences. This is an SF or fantasy show that is actually the biggest drama in Britain, or that gets the highest ratings for a non-soap drama in Britain when it's on. There isn't a show in the American consciousness like that. Because most American SF and fantasy shows are niche shows, no matter how successful they are. I mean, Heroes and Lost recently have been top 10 shows, and I guess The X-Files. But never a number one, you know. And over here, it's just, it's not seen so much as SF, but a kind of the epitome of family viewing. You know, the thing which the toddlers to the granny will all be in the same room watching at the same time. You know, it's a tremendously satisfying show to work on, because the next day everybody in my little town, you know, watched my show. And when I was working on medical shows and things like that, that just was not the case. And it's been the thing I've been a fan of all my life.
That was my question. I mean, were you just a huge fan of Doctor Who forever? I mean, this must be like a dream come true, really.
Well, yeah. I mean, I became a TV writer in order so that when Doctor Who was brought back, I would stand the chance of working on it.
You're very forward thinking.
Well, thank you very much. That was my plan. And, you know, I've written loads of Doctor Who novels and audio plays and things like that. And, you know, it was also my first comics. It's really the central thread of my life. And it's really nice that I've been able to use that to go off and, you know, do other stuff as well.
Can you explain can you explain the premise of Doctor Who to people who haven't seen it?
Goodness. Okay, well, let me see. 45 years of continuity starting now. No, actually, it's not like that at all. It's very simple. It's like the Lone Ranger. The Doctor is a Time Lord. He travels through time and space in a police box, which is a sort of old-fashioned British police call box, only used by policemen. And in 1963, that was a very ordinary thing to see on the streets. But it was discontinued in the 1980s, so now it's just the TARDIS, his spaceship, two kids and nothing else. He shows up, things are going wrong, aliens are invading either on an alien planet or Earth, either right now or back in the past, and he defeats the aliens and makes everything well again, using only his wits and his great intelligence and never a violent solution. He doesn't like guns at all. He doesn't like carrying them. It's him and his human companions against monstrous aliens with only intelligence to back him up. And it's kind of a horror show for 8-year-olds. It's designed to scare 8-year-olds. I don't think there ever has been another show with that premise, really.
is the show now different than it was in the 80s? Is the premise different, or is the same, just updated?
It's been the same premise throughout, but the lead actor has changed a lot.
Yeah, I know when I was a kid, it was always like on television, in terms of there was like the PBS channels always had it, and it was always there. And I always see it, and then I always be intimidated by it, because you'd heard it had been on for 45 years, and you were just like, and you'd turn it on for a few seconds, and it'd be seem overwhelming, and there was scarves and smoke.
There we are. It stopped in 1989, was cancelled.
Well, let me ask you, as the person clearly who I know who is the foremost authority on Doctor Who, where would be a good place to start?
Well, pick any of the new episodes, really, will give you a feeling for it. Because it's sort of like an anthology show, because the Doctor shows up at a new planet every time. I mean, there is continuity in that some of these villains come back quite often. And, you know, we learn about the lives of his companions and their families and stuff. But, you know, it's designed to be friendly to pick up on. If you want to go back for the old show, well, you'll find loads of websites with different people's opinions on what was good or what was bad. You find an early Tom Baker will give you a sense of, you know, what the show was like when it was big and gothic. Because it's gone through all these different flavors and phases. And that's one of the lovely things about the fandom. We can never quite decide on what's really great, because it's changed so much. It's all these different things. So, you know, there's all this interesting, crunchy breadth to it.
You've done all sorts of different things. I mean, you've written for TV, you're doing radio plays, you've done novels, you're doing comics now. Does it all seem sort of like the same thing to you? Do they each require sort of a different type of concentration, or I mean, what do you prefer?
Yeah, well, it's you have to sort of mentally shift gears to write each different thing. And I love prose. I mean, I think any writer who's had the chance to work in prose will say that's your ultimate. That's what everything else stems from. Because you're in control of everything, because you can vary the speed of thought, the reading speed, how quickly things are described. You are the director and the lighting guy and all the cast. What I love about the different forms is it's all about economy in different ways. On television, it's about money. You don't have much money to spend. You're not going to be out in the wilds at night. And your supporting cast aren't going to speak unless they really have to. And you're trying to get over the information on the scene as quickly as possible. In comics, you've got an infinite budget money-wise, because you can show a billion scrolls, although the artist is going to kill you. That's what you're possible. But you can show things that would be far too expensive for television, but you've only got so much room on the page, so many number of panels, so many words you can have per balloon. So it's a question of marshalling your resources in different ways. Moving from writing television to comics is especially difficult, because when you write a TV scene, you'll say he walks through the door. When you write a comics panel, okay, what does that involve? You've got a still frame there. Has he grabbed the doorknob? Is he halfway through the door? Is he looking back over his shoulder as he's through the door? You know, it's about not writing movement. I think a lot of guys, myself included, who came from television, found it difficult and... It only becomes instinctive over a long time to work out where you break up a moving scene of people talking or moving to fit it onto a comics page. This has become really... Are you guys still there?
I'm wrapped.
So dull.
Is the impulse to over-explain in the beginning, to write too much into your script and too much into the dialogue and everything?
Very much. I'm still too talky on occasion. You can usually sum it up much more quickly even than in telly, especially when you've got a really great artist like Leonard who can do facial expression so well. But there is an advantage over television in that you can go back and, you know, adjust speech balloons to suit exactly the mood of that face, which you can only do on television if they're facing away, or, you know, you can slip in a bit of dialogue post-production.
You're George Lucas and you can redo their faces, but I've noticed that a lot of TV writers will come in and their first couple of works will be, you know, very wordy because they're not used to the format and the style, so it's an adjustment period. But you seem to handle it pretty quickly. You've come.
Well, thank you. I think in wisdom was my learning period, really. I think we hit the ground running with Cap. And, you know, there's early on in Wisdom, I'm clearly finding my feet. I think we really get there by the end of the volume, and the whole volume really works as one story, which I'm very proud of. With Cap, I'm just immensely pleased. I'm just getting the pages in of issue 4 now, and they look so marvelous, and the ending just looks so great. Leonard just makes me continually look like a really good writer, and that's the really nice thing. You can just, you know, bask in the reflected glory of a great artist.
Now, you've got a couple of more projects that you can't talk about, so we can't talk about those. Those will be in the future, I guess. But that's going to be, how do you get all this stuff going on? I mean, I feel, are you working on things a bit here and there? Do you like work on a novel in the daytime, in the morning, and then off to the writer's room for the TV show? And
no, I try and, over here we don't have the writer's room culture. So
yeah, I guess not.
Yeah, you're working on the TV show here. But I try and do 2,000 words of novel no matter what I'm doing, and either 5 pages of TV or 5 pages of comics. And at the moment, it's working out so that, you know, the spinning plates haven't got in the way of each other. Mm-hmm. So this is good. And it's quite refreshing. A change is as good as a rest. And moving from one thing to another, in fact, feels like a nice deal at the moment. I'm pitching... I have show pitches at the moment for my own shows at 2 at the BBC, 1 at ITV. And there's also a couple of other things I'm doing. I'm going to stay put in comics. I very much understand, the urge of people who are in the writer's room environment, who are writing multiple episodes of ongoing shows, like the wonderful Alan Heinberg, to say, I can't do justice to this and do justice to comics at the same time. I'm going to choose and then come back later. One of the things I always loved in comics are guys who stay on for really long runs. Marv Wolfman on Tomb of Dracula, Claremont on X-Men, people who just put down the work for a long haul, and I'm just putting in my first little, we don't necessarily know what that means right now, but maybe way down in the future we'll find out what that meant. And this feels like just the most natural thing in the world to me, and I'm hoping we can do a long haul. We definitely have 12 issues of Cap, which is a fantastic commitment from Marvel. And, the way it's been performing, we all want issue 13. We all want just to keep going and keep going. And, I'm hoping we're doing things to try and cultivate an actual dialogue between us and the readership. Talking about where my blog is, saying come along and use that as a letters page. That way of pulling people in and saying this is your comic, this is here for you. It's not just that British book and it's not that other book. It's a book which does blockbuster superhero widescreen stuff with the intelligent bits, with the character bits, with the emotional bits. I'm liking it to we're after the Lord of the Rings movies, where you've got the big action sequences, but you care about the characters so much. And this is sort of what made me love comics when I was a kid. I've been reduced to tears by comics panels, and actually I still am. And this is horrible.
It happens to me more frequently than I would like to admit.
I knew you were going to say that. But it happened to me most recently because of Leonard. One shouldn't talk about this about one's own comic, but he'd just drawn a facial expression with a particular emotion on it so well that I just got it on my screen and went, oh no. But I cry easily. I was crying at a Lord of the Rings trailer in the cinema once. But actually...
What part?
It was for the third one where it looked like Aragorn might get his sword and reclaim his birthright, and I was just in big bad tears. And my wife sitting beside me can always tell because there's this motion I make, there's this wobbling of my shoulders that happens when we're sitting next to each other in the cinema, which sort of says, oh, he's crying again. But the comic that did this most recently for me actually was the last issue of Buffy. Drew Goddard, isn't he good?
It was ridiculously good.
Yeah, it was Dracula becoming sort of all, kind of serious and heroic again after a lot of Buffy kind of let's undermine the myth sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Goodness, that guy has a, if he wants it, he's got a real future in comics. He's so good. And Mechagdor.
That series was just an emotional gut punch after one after another.
Well, an emotional gut punch after a certain amount of tomfoolery stimulation in the first issue, but anyway, do go on.
I mean, you seem like a guy who you love this medium. You've gotten to a place where you're getting to do all these things that you love, and Lord knows that everybody who reads comics thinks that they can make them. Like, what kind of advice would you give to people who want to get involved with this stuff? Like, what was the single most important thing that you did to get where you are?
Oh, I think I do have one sentence for aspiring writers, which is when offered criticism of your work by somebody who is well placed to give it, that is an editor or a publisher or somebody who knows of what they speak, this is not a sentence anymore, it's a paragraph, listen to what they're telling you and change your work because of it. That sort of, always keeps you moving along the way. You can tell a non-writer in those conversations. Because when the editor says, you shouldn't have done this, they'll go, no, you see, what I was trying to aim for, and they won't just go, yes, I'll change that. And that actually, it hurts a lot to be told that stuff. And it hurts a lot to say, yes, I'll change that. But that's where wisdom lies, being punched. But in terms of the one thing I did in the career, oh, goodness, always be nice, be sociable, don't be an idiot.
Don't be an idiot.
Well, yeah, because, you know, people like working with people who are cool, who, I mean to say, who are friendly, who who don't get on their high horses at a moment's notice. You wouldn't think so, looking at the comics industry, frankly. It seems to have been organized along entirely different principles, but, you know, you see edit interviews with old creators who say, you know, and I'm making up an example here, they made me change the color of his cape, and I didn't think I could work under those circumstances, so I walked. In television, it's like, my goodness, that these guys don't know what bullying is. You know, you work on a TV show, you're going to get more hassle than that immediately as you walk through the door. It's going to continue for the whole production. I think this is maybe a reason why, not that it was ever like that on Doctor Who, which is a lovely place full of lovely people, and, you know, I will forever be available for selection by them because they're great. But on other shows I've worked on, it's like that. I think this is one reason why the comics industry employs so many TV writers, because we come pre-bullied. You know,
you're talking about Coronation Street, aren't you?
Yes, that was a terrible, terrible experience. I bounced down the steps. But no, we're not about to leap up and down about tiny things. And not that, you know, a lot of comics writers do, but some do. Yeah, so I think it's being a sociable guy, always looking to learn, you know, kind of grabbing those tiny... Everybody who's got into writing has a different way they got into it. We've all got a different mad story, because there's not one ladder, there's not an apprenticeship process. Mm-hmm. You've always got to grab that one opportunity and hang on. It's always tough. Comics especially so. It took me a long, long time to get into comics.
And it was from a random email from a guy who watched the show, happened to be Mark Miller.
Yeah, there we are. And, you know, you can't say to, an aspiring comics writer, well, I think you should get Mark Miller to email you and invite you.
After you've written a Doctor Who episode he particularly enjoyed.
Exactly. But, you know, that's not... You know, that's still part of a process, you know, which started way, way back with those very basic. Yeah, so, I'm being boring about craft here, goodness.
To me, it's fascinating, so the silence is listening, it's not yawning.
But I can hear there's a bleep bleep of a Nintendo DS there as well.
Yeah, oh, well, oh, that's sure, yeah.
That's always on, it's never off.
Come on, I'm young and I don't have a good attention span. Anyway, yeah, you know, I think we covered all the stuff that we've got going on, and anything else you want to add?
Just that I really, really appreciate everybody who's buying Cap. You know, it's gone way beyond the level we expected, and we'll just keep on doing our best to do this big, stonking superhero title every month. You know, that's what we're after. You guys making it Pick of the Week was one of the best moments for me for ages. I love that. Well, thank you so much.
It was very good. Thank you for writing it.
Well, you know, I'm reading so many titles because of you guys. You know, I'm reading Scalp now. You know, you've just turned me onto all sorts of things.
Well, that's a good question to ask. What are the things you're enjoying right now? What are your favorite things right now? Your books,
apart from Buffy, I love Bendis. I think his Avengers books are terrific. What else is cool? What's cool that people... I loved Gail Simone's run on The Atom. I think it's a pity that book is being allowed to be cancelled. I follow Gail on almost everything she does. I'm enjoying her Wonder Woman at the moment. I really liked the first issue of 1985. Actually, I liked Old Man Logan more. I thought that was great.
Mm. Josh.
I didn't love it. What do you want?
Oh, and if you like Star Wars, Rob Williams... his Star Wars Rebellion for Dark Horse always has really good photorealistic artists who can do the likenesses, and he's got a real sense of how a Star Wars story feels, you know, how it plays. And he's doing the Indiana Jones upcoming for Dark Horse as well, so I think he's somebody to look out for.
Everybody tells us to read those Star Wars books.
I guess we should. Yeah. Rebellion seems a nice entrance level title as well, because I don't know anything about the details of the Star Wars universe, and I really enjoy it.
Well, thanks so much. It was actually very much fun talking to you.
You seem surprised, but thank you.
I really like, and I think it shows that there's sort of a lot of passion for the book that you're doing, and that to me is what makes good comic books. We always talk about seeing the love on the page and seeing the fact that you want to be doing it. It's not a work for hire thing.
Well, sure. The British self-effacement always trips American interviewers up. Sorry about that. but thank you very much, and I appreciate you guys' support of it. It's really welcome.
Well, that's easy when it's good.
Cheers.
Thank you. Thanks again to Paul for being so gracious with his time and spending time with us. That was a lot of fun. And for doing good comics, make sure you check out his work. Get over to ifanboy.com and you can chat about this and everything else that's over there. And we'll see you later. Thanks.